performance poet Benjamin Zephaniah will be immersing himself in the sounds and stories of an ancient epic poem. Poetry Please is at 4:30. First on BBC Radio 4, it's our monthly date with Book Club. Here's James Naughty.
Hello. Our guest in Book Club today isn't a novelist. He's a child psychologist who says that in his writing he's trying to hold a mirror up to society. And the book we're talking about is one that catches a fairly disturbing reflection of our world. It was published in 2007. It's called Affluenza, a word that has quickly found its way into the language. And the author, here with a group of readers, is Oliver James. Now, describing the thesis of the book, I suppose, is quite easy. It argues that the habits of modern industrial societies, acquisition, competitive wealth-making, organised greed, far from producing happiness, are the source of a kind of disease. Lots of misery, even a greatly increased incidence of mental illness. Now, Oliver James travelled around the world in search of evidence for the way the affluenza virus has spread. You'll be pleased to hear that he does offer his own prescription for a kind of cure. He calls the last section of the book, Wakey Wakey. Oliver, welcome to Book Club.
Hello.
Did you find it a depressing task to describe what's wrong, or did you find it exhilarating?
Oh, I think I found it exhilarating. What really got me started was the evidence that I just didn't know about, that, in fact, if you place too high a value on money, possessions, appearances and fame, or one or all of those, you are significantly more likely to suffer from depression, anxiety, substance abuse, or personality disorder. And that, to me, is an astonishing body of evidence that it's true. And that's really what got me going. And I just was really scouting around the world to see how this was panning out.
And we're talking here about evidence. It's important to make that point. It's not just a hunch on your part, a sort of an essay about the state of the world. It is a scientist's observation.
Indeed. The World Health Organization have done a study of the amount of mental illness around the world, and it shows that there is twice as much mental illness in the English-speaking nations compared with mainland continental Europe. And I think that is absolutely incredible. So if you live in Germany or Italy or one of the mainland continental European countries, on average 11.5% have suffered a mental illness in the last 12 months, compared with if you live in the UK, America, Canada, New Zealand or Australia, on average 23%, nearly a quarter of the population, have suffered a mental illness in the last 12 months. And I put this down to the fact that we've had what, call it Thatcherism, Reaganomics, neoliberalism, or what I call selfish capitalism, I believe is what explains this huge difference. And selfish capitalism, of course, causes the affluenza, and affluenza is what makes the difference.
We'll tease that idea out, no doubt, as the discussion goes on. Let's have a first question.
Do you think the credit crunch will cure us of affluenza?
I absolutely embrace the credit crunch with both arms. And I realise, of course, that it will put a lot of people out of jobs, but we are very addicted to affluenza. But I do think that what's happened, it's extraordinary, really, in the last few months, really since the Lehman Brothers went down in the autumn, that there has been a massive collapse in the whole neoliberal project. It's actually been proven conclusively not to work in its own terms. They've had to start privatising banks right, left and centre. I mean, I'm old enough to remember British Leyland. Talk about the government bailing out cars in America. It's unbelievable. I do feel that what's happened is as radical a change as when the Soviet Union went down. It certainly happened as fast and as unexpectedly. I think neoliberalism has been completely wiped out in a matter of months. It's quite extraordinary. Of course it's going to make us better in the sense that we're living in Never Never Land, in a sort of it could be you credit-fueled consumer binge. We're in a really bad state of mind where we thought widescreen TVs were much more important than playing with our toddlers. And yes, of course, there'll be an awful lot of people feeling very unhappy because they've lost their job or worrying a lot about money. But with any luck, people will actually change their values, that they'll start concentrating on being rather than having and on meeting real needs rather than wants.
In other words, once the hangover is over, we'll feel better.
It could be the beginning of a radical change in our mental health for the better.
There's a lot of academic and scientific evidence in Affluenza and also the companion volume. So I'm interested why, on the one hand, you see it's so important as maintaining that link with the academic community, and on the other hand, putting it to a wider audience, and particularly why these ideas do need to go to a more popular audience. I hope you're not just going to say because of the money.
I think that the particular trajectory that I've followed in my career is rather peculiar, I think, in many ways. And I started off working in a mental hospital, obviously. I haven't really had a game plan as such. On a personal level, I would say both my parents were psychoanalysts, but they were fascinated by the wider implications of how patterns of childcare at the time, like they were both very involved in the child guidance movement and trying to change the whole way in which people were cared for as children, and they saw that as something that would change the whole society. So that sort of way of thinking was something that got very pickled into me and probably turned me into a bit of a bigot and into a bit of a megalomaniac, to the extent that I am sort of terribly interested in trying to promulgate these kinds of ideas to as many people as possible. I freely admit that. I also, it's probably rather selfish, really, but on a purely selfish level, I am quite scholarly. My dad was very scholarly, and I've sort of got a bit of that in me, and there's a big part of me that wants to actually read all the scientific evidence and really work things out from that point of view. So I'm interested in trying to tell the truth as the science guides me. I really am interested in that, too. And so writing The Selfish Capitalist, The Scientific Companion of Affluenza, seemed to me vital, but you couldn't fit it all into one book. It would have been a massively thick volume. And also, the sort of people who might want to read the scientific evidence aren't necessarily the same sort of people as want to hear the story, if you like, that is Affluenza.
Now, Oliver, as we've mentioned, you went round the world in search of evidence. You met people. I want you to give us a reading in a moment. And you keep up with them, by the way. Have you gone back?
Some of them, yeah. Not all of them, by any means.
No, but well, that would be difficult. Yeah. Tell us where you're going to read from.
Well, when I was in New York, a friend of mine called Tom took me to see a friend of his called Sam. Well over 6 feet tall and built like a boxer, Sam has already inherited a huge amount of money and will inherit even more when his father dies, perhaps £1 billion. But he's also highly motivated to make his own, earning about £20 million a year through his investment company, enough to pay for his own private jet and many homes around the world without drawing on his inheritance. He spends little time here in New York, constantly travelling, often to Russia, on whose women he seems very keen. Apparently, in New York, it's possible to call up a real model agency and get them to send one over, like a pizza. Of course, he says, you give them a present at the end of the evening or the next morning, but these girls also are real models. He'd recently met the main scout for Russian models here, and only last night had been introduced to an 18-year-old who is so perfect that she looks as if she is just hatched from an egg. You know something interesting? I swear that when they're young, they really do taste different. That is just how one might speak of the upholstery of an expensive car or some other possession. His view of women as manipulable commodities is underlined by his next comment. What's so great about the Russian women is that they only want to get out of there. A visa or some practical help, that's enough to make them happy. My girlfriend in London has got a student visa and lives in my flat there. That's all she wants from me. Tom, my friend, is astonished to hear that Sam has a girlfriend, saying, what makes you call her your girlfriend compared with the four or five other girls you've always got on the go? Rather testily, Sam replies, oh, she lives in my flat. She's my girlfriend. Perhaps he's beginning to feel a bit abnormal compared with his friends, and he wants a social possession of this category as a sign that he's not weird.
Very nice. At the back here and then.
If I had a criticism of the book, it was that a lot of, perhaps it's just the people I remember, because they're the most striking, they're the super rich. And one person you found who you said positively didn't have Affluenza was the taxi driver in New York, who was struggling along. He had to get money to pay for his kids to go to college. Did you interview a lot of other people? And if it is Affluenza, surely it's got to be more of a strata of society than just the super rich. The evidence didn't seem to be there that it was permeating absolutely everything, if it's to be viral.
Absolutely, though, it is everywhere. But the reason I did deliberately want to look at millionaires, because as a group, if money makes you happy, if money is going to produce fulfillment and mental health, then it ought to amongst millionaires. Now, I was startled at how incredibly screwed up they were. I mean, I knew they'd be pretty screwed up, but I didn't realise it would be quite that bad. But as for the sort of general population, of course, you're right that there are less taxi drivers, if you like. I would say the key thing, of course, is that we're talking, always talking about the difference between survival materialism and relative materialism. And I'm very explicit in saying that it's not inequality of itself that screws everybody up. It's inequality when combined with the wrong values. So it's possible to have massive inequality in Nigeria or indeed in Shanghai and have very low rates of mental illness. The problem is when you get wild relative deprivation, which everybody's saying, you know, feeling entitled to and imagining that their life will be infinitely better if they're as rich as the richest people. That's where the trouble is. And of course, survival materials, if you're in Africa and you've got a child dying of a bacterial infection and you're desperately trying to get enough money to afford some antibiotics, that's not going to make you mentally ill. Obviously not. You know, survival materialism doesn't make people mentally ill. It's relative materialism. And that's why millionaires are so interesting, though, because they're completely off the map, far away from needing any more money, and yet they're all obsessed with getting more.
Couple here.
I was wondering, how do we inoculate ourselves against the chief causes of infection, i.e. advertising? And is it possible to get an influenza jab?
I'm always staggered by, you know, the power of the evidence that watching television is bad for your mental health. I mean, there's a very good book by somebody called Eric Sigmund called Remotely Controlled, which is an excellent summary of the evidence. And obviously, just don't watch telly. Hardly at all. Maybe watch BBC 4, but that's about it as far as I can see. Listen to Radio 4. So at a very simple level, the more that children can be weaned off watching telly, the more that we wean ourselves off watching telly. There's an excellent book by Tom Hodgkinson called How to Be Idle, which is actually not the title suggests it's just all about lying around. It isn't. It's all about much more valuable, interesting things to be doing with your time than the things that the consumer encouraging media are trying to, you know, foist on you.
The proposal I found most attractive in the book was that mothers should be paid a decent wage, or fathers, as agreed between the parents, paid a decent wage to care for children, which, I mean, I think that really is fantastic and revolutionary and would make a really big difference. I just wanted to ask two things, really. What you thought the effect would have on society generally if that was actually implemented? And secondly, what about children over three? Because, I mean, I know from my own experience that when the children are over three, you're still under a lot of pressure. You know, really, it does sort of carry on. And it just seems a very sudden cut-off point, three. And then, sorry, a third question, which is, how can we make this kind of idea happen, this reordering of priorities?
That's quite a big question.
I feel passionately that what happens in the first 6 years profoundly affects what kind of mental health you have. It, like, kind of sets the electrochemical thermostat, which it can be changed. I'm not saying it's completely destiny, but it's really significant. And at the moment, whether you're a mother or a father, or whether you're a woman or a man, we're under such a lot of pressure to put money first that in the end I thought, well, okay, sod it. Well, if that's the only way that people will take it seriously, pay them the national average wage, you know. And I do believe that it's a serious suggestion. I mean, if it's possible for us to start nationalising the car industry or buying all the banks, why, really now, anything's possible, frankly, in terms of the practicalities, as I say in the book. There's nothing to stop us not having a new Trident missile system. 1% of the British landmass is owned by the Ministry of Defence. How come none of that gets privatised? You know, there are all sorts of things we could do to pay for this, and boy, would it improve the mental health of the 0 to 6-year-olds. Whether you stick at three, I don't know. You know, I'm not a social administrator in the final analysis, but I would have thought you could create a society which just infinitely put more interest for parents to stay at home and look after the children.
Hi, I'm a teacher and have used your book a lot as a teaching resource. And it's been really interesting and quite surprising and positive, the feedback I've had from the students. They're totally aware of the virus and they don't like what it does to them in terms of coming to school with hair straighteners and makeup and striving really hard to get the good exam results. But they're really aware of what it does to them. And I just love the fact that they can enjoy to an extent the frivolity of the virus, but they hopefully most of the time don't let it get to their soul because they know what really matters. I mean, do you think it's possible to have a sort of cake and eat it situation without having the utopia of a blind society where we ignore people's material possessions? Because I do see that happening, certainly in the fairly deprived school I'm in.
I do think so. I mean, I feel that there's a light will come shining through. You know, I think that it's like with the credit crunch. I think people have this tremendous feeling of, Oh, thank goodness, that's over. You know, it dragged on for 30 long years. We were all obsessed with our cars and our televisions and our conservatories. And now suddenly we can actually just say, sod it. You know, it doesn't really matter at all. And I quite agree. Now, I think teenagers do instinctively, even if they've been brainwashed in New York, there's still a part of them that knows that this is all rubbish and it's not meeting their needs.
But don't you think people are still going to want their conservatories and their cars and all the rest of it? They're going to hunker down for a year or two, weather the storm, and then venture out of the cave again onto the wintry landscape and start buying.
I think it just completely depends on whether our politicians get their act together.
Let's ask our teacher. I'd just like to know what reaction your pupils have to the book when they first encounter it, because it's a different kind of book from the one they would normally get in school. It takes them onto different territory. It urges them to think about the world in a different way. How do they respond to it?
Well, the chapter I've discussed with them is the one where you talk about the high-performing girls' school, where the girls have got pressures to get a stream of A's and look fabulous and to get into top universities. I mean, the students particularly like the book because they're being treated as adults in the discussion, because they do see it as part of their lives and what's going to affect them. It's happening day to day. They've got a copy of Heat magazine and the lipstick, but they know what matters at the end of the day. They know that secure family and friends do, you know, keep their life moving forward.
So we haven't completely lost the plot.
No.
You're listening to Book Club on BBC Radio 4. Oliver James is talking about his book, Affluenza. Yes.
Why is Affluenza so particularly an English-speaking virus? You say in the book that its epicentre is New York. But why has it affected other English-speaking countries? Is it a matter of culture rather than geography? Language rather than geography? What is that about, do you think?
Well, I've actually written a scientific companion to Affluenza called Selfish Capitalist, which tries to explain this in full scientific, glorious detail. But of course, I don't claim that my explanation is completely comprehensive, but what I maintain is that the great difference with the English-speaking nations compared with continental mainland Europe is that we have had what I call selfish capitalism, which is defined as that businesses are evaluated by their short-term share price. The market can fix any problem under selfish capitalism. You have massive privatization and you get massive economic inequality. And those things are peculiar to the English-speaking nations in the last 30 years. For 30 years, we've had this disastrous form of political economy. I maintain that it has been catastrophic because of its impact on our levels of materialism. It makes everybody feel that they're very insecure in their jobs, everybody obsessed with trying to have more money than everybody else, the it could be you mentality, the deregulated financial services, which means everybody borrows far more than they can afford, and you wrap it all up together, and what you end up is with people who place too high a value on money, possessions, appearances, and fame. And as the studies show, if you do that, it means you're chasing wants rather than your real psychological needs, and that makes you more prone to depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and personality disorder. And I think that the evidence is there that that's the case, and that's why we're twice as mentally ill compared with mainland continental Europe.
In the book, you talk about Denmark being an example of what I guess you might call unselfish capitalism. What is it about their way of doing things that you discovered on your travels for the book that you think was the key to being better than we are?
For 70 years, they've really been putting well-being ahead of profit. And a simple way they do that is to keep the gap between the rich and the poor very small. So when I went to interview the equivalent of the editor of The Guardian there, a chap called Toker Seidenfaden, he's only paid 5 times more than the taxi driver who took me there. He says also that they really anticipated the effects of feminism. They really thought it through and they've really made a big effort to persuade boys and then men to regard the way they are fathers and the way they contribute to the domestic household economy as absolutely central to the whole system, so that the women really are supported by the men, that they're not just left holding the baby. And the state, it's a culture that's evolved over 70 years that means that conspicuous consumption will not get you anywhere. If you're a man and you want to pull in Copenhagen, you do not do it by driving a Ferrari. If you're a woman, you don't do it by wearing a short skirt. They have a different values about the mating rituals there, and they really do. It's not just empty rhetoric. So that it's really possible in that system for people to be interested in what kind of parents other people are going to be like when deciding who to marry. Unimaginable, I know, but it is actually the case.
Yes. There was a programme recently broadcast on Radio 4 about Denmark, an item I was intrigued because I was reading the book at the time. And one thing emphasised, or two things, one was the small size of Denmark and also the homogeneity of the community, very little in terms of immigration. And I was just curious as to whether multiculturalism has an effect on affluenza, or the opposite in Denmark, where there's very little multiculturalism, whether it has a positive effect on the nature of the culture there.
The standard response to my advocacy of Scandinavian countries as being good, and I'm not saying they're perfect, and in the book I don't say they're perfect, there are certain things that we as Brits would say are rather dull about, frankly, the Danes are terribly friendly in a rather boring way, frankly, and I think you always say you have to be sort of mildly depressed to live in Britain, sort of falsely self-disparaging, etc., etc. Well, they're not like that. They're the key... The argument everyone says is, oh, yes, but they're all drunk and they commit suicide more, which neither of which are true, compared, you know, actually, you know, epidemiologically, they're not particularly drunk or particularly suicidal. But above all, people, usually of the right, come out with this dreadful expression, homogeneity. Absolute rubbish, you know, it's absolutely not true at all. It's not actually true that they're completely homogenous. They do take in a lot of refugees. They're enormously concerned about not screwing up the planet, so they spend an awful lot of money on their ecological programs. But above all, the point I would make is that they do not suffer from conspicuous consumption. So that what retailers find of luxury, luxury retailers find, is that you just can't get anywhere with the Danes. If you go in there with an iPod before everybody's got an iPod or an iPhone before everyone's got an iPhone, it's hopeless. You won't sell any until it comes down to a price where everybody can afford it, and then suddenly everybody will have one. And that's the mentality. You know, as I say, I don't think it's a perfect society. I think that I rather wish, my wife is pointing out, what I really should have done at the end of Affluenza was just do a sort of map of the world in which I took the best bits of all the different societies. You know, the Muscovite women's attitude to beauty, the all the best bits. I couldn't really think of anything I'd take from New York, actually. But, yeah. Anyway,
I was just wondering if you think there's any hope at all for New Yorkers.
There's always hope. And of course, I mean, one of the things I did notice in New York, actually, that surprised me was that I talked to quite a few people there, including one that I described in the book, a woman who had an awful childhood and had the most wonderful psychoanalysis. I think they do have very, very superior therapy in New York. But unfortunately, that's a rather expensive and rare phenomenon. I think, is there hope for New York? I mean, I think what the world has changed so much in the last 50 years, if you think about how rapidly now things move, and the rate at which things can change has increased so fast, that I think that it is perfectly feasible that the people in New York, under Obama, who knows? Obama may turn out to be unbelievably good. Who knows? So anything could happen. I really do think that it is perfectly feasible that New York could become, it's full of, got many amazing virtues. Of course it has. Its arts and the intellectuals and a great deal of the best social science there is comes from America. And of course, I'm not saying everything in America is rubbish. So yes, of course it could.
There just isn't enough room in Copenhagen for them all.
Oliver, in the book, you talk about, of the people that you meet, that there are a set of characteristics that are intrinsic and key, really, to emotional maturity and contentedness, those being authenticity, vivacity and playfulness. How can we realistically, as a society and, you know, as families, teach our children those characteristics, not just within the family, but also within the school and the education system as well?
Well, the education system, of course, I strongly advocate, you know, much less target-driven, much more trying to encourage scholarship, much more trying to... at the moment, the education system is just about producing good little consumer producers who will quietly slot into the career system. So, in a way, education has actually become an extension of this ghastly phrase, human resources departments of corporations. And I think that... in terms of what we do at home with our children, it's about, first and foremost, being there with them, showing a lot of love for them and a lot of tolerance towards them and not treating them like little beasts in the nursery that need to be tamed. I loathe the sort of super nanny-ish rota-based way of trying to bring children up to meet the needs of the parents rather than the needs of the small child. The babies, their needs need to be met on the basis of what their needs are, not the parents' needs. And as toddlers, it's essential that they have somebody who they're very familiar with if they're going to be secure when they grow up. So, that kind of thing is going to be a great fan. Obviously, the more that parents are valued, the more that they're encouraged to stay at home and hang out with each other, playing with frolicking, happy little groups of children, that will provide the foundation for authenticity, vivacity and playfulness. The more of that, the better.
At the back here.
So, drawing from the research in your book, what would be your top tips for feeling great in a recession?
That's a very nice question.
Well, for feeling great in a recession or not in a recession, my top tips, in the book I try to list the sort of vaccines against the virus, and they're things like, if you're a woman, concentrate on being pleased with the person you're looking at in the mirror, rather than worrying, as most, I'm afraid, English-speaking women do, present company accepted, no doubt, when they look in the mirror, they tend to think, first and foremost, will other women of my age envy what I'm looking at? And then secondly, will men like what I'm looking at? Whereas when I was I went to New Zealand, Australia, Singapore, Shanghai, Moscow, Copenhagen and New York. And in Copenhagen and in Moscow, women have a completely different attitude to themselves as compared with the English-speaking women. That is, they really are concerned with trying to be beautiful. So my motto in that chapter in the book is be beautiful, not attractive. That's one example. Another example which I feel is very relevant nowadays is to actually just try to stop worrying about improving your home. Either try to get a bigger home in a more fashionable area or building that conservatory or redoing the kitchen. Forget that stuff. What do you need for a kitchen? It just needs to be something, which has flat surfaces or something you can cook on, preferably a fridge. Once it's beyond that, why do people spend tens of thousands of pounds, which have to work ridiculous hours? It's actually because they want to keep up with the Joneses, and we can just forget that. That's another example.
Oliver James, thank you very much for being our guest on this month's book club and talking about affluenza. Next month's book, which I hope you'll be reading with us, is The Last Kingdom by Bernard Cornwell, a novel set in Saxon England. Next week at this time, Mariella Frostrup will be here with Open Book, and her guest is Jay McInerney. Remember our website, bbc.co.uk.